Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 89 of Crosshairs Radio. 89. We're getting up there. We're going to hit 100 this season. That's going to be fun. I'll have something special to celebrate for that. We got some special things coming up. Well, first off, I still need to give away this Wout Van Aert pair of socks to a donor. These world championship socks that have been signed. We'll do that during the next TDDTIE. And then also some cool promotional stuff I'm working with on Nationals that you guys are going to be pretty stoked about, at least for one of you, maybe. So that's all coming up, too, in the future. But right now, I'm talking to Adam Meyerson about the USA Cycling meeting that he just attended in Colorado, where all of the representatives, athlete reps got together and talked about the state of cycling. And, you know, Adam has a lot to report back on that meeting. And that's what we spent the next 90 minutes talking about. It's always great to talk to Adam. I think we have some good in-depth conversations, and I think you're going to dig it. Life insurance, that's something you need, and Health IQ can help you get it. They can get you lower rates because you are a person with a healthy lifestyle. That's their whole goal. They are a life insurance company that celebrates the health conscious, including cyclists. And if you go to healthiq.com/cxhairs, you can learn more. You can get a free quote, and you can check out their life insurance FAQ page in case there's stuff about life insurance you don't know. And I would recommend and sort of urge all of you to do that, because you hear me say it all the time. I'm even struggling to get through this because I know you guys know this. And if you're new, oh, you really got to know this. And just go to healthiq.com/cxhairs, take the quick survey, you know, chat with those guys. And that continues their support of us and your support of them. And we're all just a big, happy family. Hey. Speaking of big happy families, the Wide Angle Podium Podcast Network is like a big happy family, and we want you to be part of it. Go to wideanglepodium.com/donate. Become a member. Like $5 a month up from there. That really helps us continue to put out all of the shows that we're doing. I'm putting out a slew of Crosshairs Radio this month. I just recorded a Dirt Fuel Recordings with Lindsay Bear, so that's up now. So go check that out. A slow ride, guys. Haven't slowed down at all. They're going. The We Got to Hang Out guys out there in the Pacific Northwest, they are killing it. Putting up great content. Honest Bicycle Program, Consummate Athlete, all of the shows, Laser Radio, you should check all of them out, and please become a member of the Wide Angle Podium, wideanglepodium.com/donate. Hey, if you want to get in touch with me, feedback@cxhairs. Also, just follow along at cxhairs. A lot of praise. Races we're going to be going to Charm City this weekend, if you catch this right when it comes out. Also, going to be around the country giving you just quality coverage, and I want you to follow along at CX Hairs Instagram, at CX Hairs on Twitter. All right. Adam Meyerson, always entertaining, always informative. He's on the podcast, and we're going to talk to him right now. All right. Adam Meyerson. See how my voice changed there? Because now we're recording. Even though the conversation is going to be the same as it was like 10 seconds ago.
Yeah, you put your professional voice on. That's similar to what Tom Parsons does when he's interviewing. We'll be having a normal conversation. The minute the camera turns on, he's all of a sudden he's Christopher Walken. He can't even stop himself. He just automatically goes, Adam Meyerson.
Which is fine. And I don't know how much it really changes, and I hope not, because that's the thing that always who's famous for it. Kerry Werner is a guy who will sit there and give you like loads of crap, and then you turn the camera on and all of a sudden it's like professional Kerry Werner. And so my goal now is just to try to get him to crack back into the, you know,
smiley
Kerry Werner, which is always good when it comes out.
Don't tell him the camera's on.
Yeah. Well, it's hard now, because now I just like stick it on my face, because I've learned that's how I can keep it stable. So people are sort of having a conversation with a lens.
What professional media training did Kerry Warner get? What team was he on? Oh, I guess he was on when they when Raleigh before I don't know what when it was Optum. Maybe he got some media training on Optum. I wonder where that comes from though.
Maybe it was Raleigh. Maybe Ben Berdan was giving him tips.
Got it somewhere.
So, Adam Meyerson, it's cyclocross season. At this point in your career, and I'm still calling it a career, even though I know you're sort of retired from whatever you're retired from, would you call, is there an on and off season?
No, not at this point. There's it's phases of the season. Yeah, it's definitely 12 months.
Yeah.
We have slower periods. It's seasonal, but there's no off season. There's just the different things that you work on at different times of the year.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. We got somebody else in the room too.
Yeah, Birdie's she's got a little I got her a little cat bed and it sits on the corner of my desk so she can sit on my desk with me while I'm working but sit in her own little bed. And I think I'm either annoying her because we started talking or
probably being too loud. Probably like, you know, just chill out, put on some music and let's get to work here.
Well, she's deaf actually. So it can't be because I'm talking. It's just she's doing laps in her little cat bed to curl up and go to sleep here.
There you go.
She's 20.
That's
she's an
amazing.
Old lady.
That
I know. I know. Every day we get with her is maybe the last day. So but she's a trooper. She's doing good.
That's good. Yeah. No, seasonal. Back to that.
Yeah.
That's a good
way
of looking at it. I sort of fell into that now in the last couple years as well, especially doing like more of the mountain bike stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's just, it's like 12 months now. So you sort of have to figure out how to balance all of that.
Yeah. Because it's, there's just the business part of the season and there's the execution part and there's the planning and preparation part. So we're always working on something. And for me, the cycle is like, I mean, there's the athlete side too, and I'm trying to train for things and periodize my training, but there's also, I've got camps. So in the summer, we're getting ready for our camps and focused on that. And these things are all happening at the same time, but in terms of what I'm focused on. And then the minute camps are over, I have to kind of turn the slider up for Vittoria series work and make sure that everything's done there and new rules are in place and the website's updated and sponsorship's done and I have everything ready in time for Gloucester to go off without a hitch. And fortunately my event isn't first. You know, Paul Boudreau's the one going crazy with Gloucester and I'm just making sure the series stuff is in place. I'm trying to keep up with him almost. He's like my deadline. You know, the first race is my deadline. But that's all done and in place right now and churning away and we picked up Cliff as a presenting sponsor this year.
Oh,
and
great. So, that's awesome.
Yeah. And you know, that is a lot of actual extra work. And Cliff is so professional at what they do for marketing. I have to step my game up a little bit because.
Oh,
you know,
I actually started doing some work for them as well. And they are.
Right. Yeah.
It's good.
I mean, the Vittoria sponsorship is serious, but it's also people that I know well and they trust me and they're happy with what they're getting. And with Cliff, I don't, you know, the marketing person he's a marketing professional. He's not a bike industry marketing professional. And it is actually different. So I've been jumping through some hoops that I haven't had to jump through before and having to provide information that I haven't had to actually even document before. So that's keeping me busy. But we're psyched. I'm glad that it's raising my game because we want to run a professional series and we want good marketing. And so I'm learning actually from working with Cliff. It's helping me get better at what I do. But so once all that's in place, you know, I just want to be helpful to Paul and make sure Gloucester goes off without a hitch. And then I'll turn all my attention to my own race. I have about a month between Gloucester and Northampton. And then once Northampton's over, I can start to focus on my own racing a little bit more. I have two more races in the series, but the admin work is done and we're just repeating what we do. We have things under control by then. and then I feel like that's why I ride better in the second half of the season.
Yeah.
It's better for me because the weather changes and the courses get more technical and colder, but also my admin work starts to lighten up in terms of race promotion.
So, all right, how would you, let's start here, because I have a sort of a progressive question, but just, so how would you categorize now your racing versus what, the road racing is pretty much you're done with, right? That was the professional part that's now done. And I'm assuming cyclocross too, as well as big travel for it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the way it was hard, I had an idea of how things would go, but I don't think there was any way to plan for it until I was in it, because it was unknown territory. And, you know, I know that there's a limit to how many hours a week I can train, and that changes based on how things are going, what my workload is like. And, you know, Flynn's two now, and so things are much different at two than they were, you know, 6 months ago and 12 months ago and a year and a half ago. So he's in daycare now full time. And so I'm able to work for most of the day and then get out for a ride. I can carve out about 2 hours for myself to use for training. Doesn't mean I can ride for 2 hours, but that's about the window that I can get up from my desk for.
Yeah.
And then I try to have a hard stop every day at 6 o'clock. So I'm leaving to drop him off for daycare at 7:30. I'm back at my desk and working by 8:39. And so I have that 9 to 6 window to do a full day of work and train. And you know, whatever else I need to do. Sometimes I go grocery shopping. You know, when you work from home, you're always busy, yeah, but you're flexible, right? So right. Yeah, sometimes I drop Flynn and Janice off at daycare, and then I go straight to the grocery store before I come home, because that's the best use of my time. I'm already out. The grocery store is really close to daycare, things like that. So just trying to be super efficient with my schedule. So what's to answer your question, I guess, so what's different is, yeah, the travel has to go. I don't travel for bike races necessarily unless they're very, very important. And so that means, you know, Masters Road Nationals and Cross Nationals. And occasionally I get an itch that I need to scratch. And so, you know, I might hop on a plane and go do 4 days of Toad, or, you know, which I did this year. You know, I had really, really good form after Masters Nationals, and I was burning a hole in my pocket. And so Janice and I were able to coordinate, you know, a half a week of me being away, and I would love to have done all of Toad, but slicing off 4 days let me get my rocks off and not die from the pain of missing my family, which is, you know, I drop them off at daycare and I miss them the minute I drive away. So
right,
that's a big part of what I'm managing. But it's just not, I feel stupid when I get too excited about wanting to race bikes, because what I really want to do is spend as much time with Flynn as I possibly can. So
and maybe that's the, so I guess what I was leading into, and since you've always been somebody who is managing a business, you're managing a series, which is a lot of work, and then also trying to race professionally, I'm looking at your clients more, you know, your master's age clients. I'm just wondering if it seems like you've always had a pretty good idea about what kind of workload people can take on when, you know, racing isn't their primary objective. And I'm just curious if that's changed at all now that your perspective has changed. Like, do you see, are you able to even more so see sort of what your clients in that demographic are dealing with?
Yes, definitely. And you're right. It's not new. And you're right that I've always been balancing multiple things and had a sense of that. But I also understood, even in those periods where I was running my coaching business or running bike races and still being a professional cyclist, I always understood I didn't have kids, I didn't set an alarm, and I had infinite flexibility. So I was always busy. But, you know, maybe I'd be in a hotel room answering emails when my teammates would go see a movie, or they'd be playing video games. I would work. But I didn't have to get up. I still slept until I woke up every day, and that was huge. But, you know, I still had time to recover. If I needed to ride for 6 hours, I rode for 6 hours, and then I worked from you know, 6 p.m. to midnight or something like that. You know, I just, that's not what my clients were really up against. I still had a very different situation than them. But, and I would say even now, I don't have a straight 9 to 5, right? So I can't sleep until I wake up anymore. I have to get up when the baby gets up, and that lately has sometimes been 5 a.m. He's getting up early for some reason. But, you know, if Janice gets up with him, the latest I'm sleeping is 7 o'clock, which is not crazy. I mean, plenty of people get up at 5 a.m. every day for work, but I had to shift my sleep schedule from midnight to 8. You know, now it's 10 to 6. It's not the end of the world. But that was a hard change to make, actually. But so I can still train in the middle of the day. And I think that is a huge advantage that I have. I'm not riding at 6 o'clock after work or at 5 o'clock before work. Those are baby hours now. So I basically take a long lunch break. That's the best way to think of it. I take the baby to daycare, but I don't have a job commute. But I am spending 90 minutes in the morning on transport now that I wasn't doing before. But Janice gets him on her way home from work, and that schedule works well for us. So I can work right up until 6 o'clock, or start getting dinner ready, you know, be ready for them when they get home. So it's just, yeah, we're still planning things. But in terms of how it relates to what my clients do, you know, Aaron Facone is a good example of someone who is really killing it as a person with real life responsibilities and priorities, who is scheduling training around her job and is very committed to the training, does not have a lot of other distractions. She has a relationship, but her partner is also a cyclist, and I think that helps. But generally, she's either training, she commutes, but she's also training before work and after work. She's doing a lot of training. Yeah. I'm asking her to do, I'm like, hey, this is the training you got to do for the goals that you have and the level you want to reach. But I also, I'd have her do more if she didn't have a job, but what she's able to get done is really impressive. And I think her improvement since I started working with her, we started last summer, so it's been just over a year and a half. You know, we invested in each other, and it's showing in her results. But I think she's a better example of a working class bike racer who's racing at a high level now, and who made really great improvements, just by, yeah, doing the work. So I think the difference is I am still, though, surprised at the level I've been able to maintain and the results that I've been getting in this past year in particular, you know, on 8 to 10 hours a week of training compared to the 20 to 30 hours a week of training I did when I was a professional.
And that's got to be important, too. I mean, right there, that's a great, you know, real life example of what you're kind of preaching to other folks.
What better advertising for our coaching business than to be out there walking the walk, right?
Yeah.
And doing it successfully. And I mean, and I will say, like, I've even had clients, you know, I had a client who had retired from the military and whose wife was overseas and still in the military. And so he was unemployed. He was jobless. I mean, not unemployed, he was retired, you know. He had unlimited training. He was a master's aged athlete with unlimited training time and a source of income for the first time in his life. You know, we would joke that he was better off than most continental pros. And so we use that time for him for training too. But he, you know, there's an example of someone who he was a master without a job and unlimited training time.
Yeah.
Like that. And other masters have to compete against that, who might have kids and a job. So everybody's got unique circumstances.
Yeah. The fun one that I'd see in our area, which is really interesting, is that part of our community down here is Western Virginia, not necessarily West Virginia, but Western Virginia. So Roanoke and Winchester and Harrisonburg. And it's a different lifestyle than DC in that everybody had kids much, much, much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you had these guys coming from that region who were 40 and had like college age kids.
Yeah.
Where in DC, 40 is where everybody's, you know, having their first kid. So yeah. So it was really interesting that shift and sort of that advantage of, you know, they were like kicking their kids out of the house already and being able to have that extra training time.
I think that's my age group in particular, you know, like all my buddies who I grew up racing with and who ducked out of racing to start careers and families are back racing again. And I'm racing with those guys in the Masters races.
Yeah.
And we talk all the time and they're watching me. I put all those things off and now I'm focused on those things at 45. But yeah, their kids are in college and my kid is 2.
Right, right. All right. So, I'm going to give you one more family sort of lifestyle question. Then we're gonna move on to why we were gonna get on this call, or you and I will sit here and talk for the next 4 hours.
Yeah.
Lindsay Bear is coming in here later this afternoon. She pregnant. Yep. I'm assuming still wants to race. What would be your biggest piece of advice for her?
Oh. To not listen to any of the advice that she gets.
Nice.
I think the thing that you learn as a parent is that you will get exactly opposite advice from people who you respect equally and would take advice from equally. So you'll have two friends who you would take advice from will tell you exactly opposite things about, you know, you have to parent this way or you have to do this thing and which advice do you take? And I think every parent knows this. And so, yeah, my advice is don't take it. Listen to all of the advice, but ultimately she's an intelligent person. She's a capable person. She and her partner should, you know, sort of trust themselves and their own common sense and instinct, because you can't follow all the advice. The advice is continually contradictory.
Yeah.
But I think everybody has a different parenting experience and you can't predict what that parenting experience is like. And as a mother, you know, I've seen female athletes racing 4 weeks after their kids were born. You know, but Janice had it a little rougher than that, and it was 6 to 12 months of just healing from pregnancy for her.
Right.
You know, and she's so Flynn's 2 now, and Janice is just starting to feel like herself again. You know, it really took her that long to, between work and just healing from childbirth. So everybody's experience is different. I wouldn't pretend to tell her what to do.
Right. All right. You were elected by your peers to be the riders representative, correct?
I'm the at-large representative.
At-large representative. For cyclocross specifically. Did I get that part right?
Yeah.
For USA Cycling. And this was kind of the first meeting for that. And this is kind of why I wanted to chat, just to get a debriefing about what went down.
Yeah. And I thought it would be useful because I know I'm going to get a lot of questions about it. You and I would have had a private conversation about it anyway. I would, you know, I want to debrief with you, but I think doing it in this format will help me get some of the info out to the constituents.
Yeah. Should we go on? Yeah. I like that word. I use that word a lot.
Yeah. But I do feel an obligation to give people an update on how it went and what we talked about and just let them know what happens in Colorado. You know, what you elected me to this sport committee. Well, what does it mean? What do we do? What did we talk about? What changes are in store? Things like that. So, yeah. And so we just had the meeting that we just had, meetings all day, Monday, Tuesday.
Can I ask you, even before we get into that? Well, you can sort of weave this into your answer. Just curious. Everybody has their feelings about USA Cycling. I know that you personally have mixed feelings about them, as we all do. I mean, there are definitely things that we're conflicted about with that organization. What were your hopes and your expectations going into this meeting?
Well, with this, it makes sense to finish what I was about to say because it sets the background for that question. So this meeting was the collection of every sport committee and every sport committee member. And not everybody attended. There were a few people that weren't able to attend. But so it's BMX, track, road, pro road, or just professional. There's a professional pro sport committee. So it's everybody.
Yeah. And mountain bike in there too.
Yeah, mountain bike. Yeah. And so it's a great meeting for that reason. And it's so a little bit of orientation process, you know, like you're some, you know, newly elected people had an orientation, but to get all of us into the same building, and then you split up for your sport committee meetings, but there are also some other, like all of the athletes from each sport committee got together from across the disciplines. Well, everybody, like whatever your constituency was, as the at-large member, I could go to whichever one I want. And just based on where we needed representation, I went to the athletes meeting. So, you know, I'm in that room with Russ Finsterwald and Allison Tetrick and Jesse Anthony and BMX athletes that I didn't know necessarily, or folks like that.
Who have maybe all of the power.
Oh, I mean, we could have a, I won't even start at that chance, but it would behoove us to pay attention to BMX.
Yes.
It's very interesting how things are working BMX, and people may not know this, but you know, freestyle BMX got added to the Olympics.
Yeah.
And so watching how that impacts BMX, and BMX is interesting because they have USA BMX. They basically have USA Cycling handling their elite, you know, Olympic level, elite level competition, UCI level competition. But they also have a USA BMX, which is purely grassroots and manages the grassroots. You know, USA Cycling has to do both of those things. And that, I got you off track. But that's a big theme for me right now. That hit hard for me during the meeting, and it came up a bunch of times. The push and pull of elite athletics versus membership.
Well, yeah, and I just wanted to highlight BMX because people, you know, may cast a lowly eye towards it, but why I said they have the power is that they are an Olympic sport, and they're an Olympic sport that the U.S. does well in, and gold is the highest currency you can have when it comes to money and funding and everything else. And so,
and they have a large grassroots organization. You know, I mean, it might be declining or whatever, but you know, BMX is popular with kids, so it's resembles soccer in that way. You know, the huge grassroots, and at least on the women's side, a high level of competition and USOC money. So, but to go back to your question, like what, talking about being sort of ambivalent or what my expectations were, I would say that for me, I am very often, a public defender of USA Cycling. And a private criticizer of USA Cycling. And I just had a text conversation with Micah Rice where I sort of put it in those terms where, you know, I've often defended him and USA Cycling publicly, but that doesn't mean I'm not having privately critical conversations with him and other people at USA Cycling where I'm saying, hey, here's the mistakes, here's what needs to happen, you know, and I appreciate that they've, even in when I had an unofficial role, have come to me for feedback and guidance, you know, on the side. And it's part of why I finally decided to run was because I wanted to formalize that a little bit more and take some responsibility and not just be a consultant sort of on the side. But I think for me, I really despise when people use USAC as this this broad pejorative, like blaming everything on USAC that they don't like about bike racing without understanding the thing they're criticizing or USAC's role in it or who the human beings at USAC are who might be responsible for that or who might be working on that and or who care about that problem too and are literally their job is to fix it and that's what they're working on every day and then you're a jackass on the internet just talking shit.
Yep.
It's what the internet's for, and I guess it's, you know, it doesn't matter that it's bike racing, it could be anything. It's what Facebook is. But, you know, for people that care about bike racing and want to see these things fixed, I have never understood mouthing off without being well informed about the thing that you're mouthing off about. So when people say, quote unquote, USAC, the thing that I've come to do lately is to ask them, well, who do you mean? Who at USAC?
Yeah.
And challenge them on that. Who are you talking about when you say that? Who is responsible for that thing that you're ranting about? And it I feel like it gets people.
Usually, and you're right, it's usually a case where if it is a valid criticism, which that's, you know, we can question whether it is, a lot of times it's the wrong organization. You know, they're pissed off at USCA about anti-doping, or they're pissed off, or, you know, it's always money grabs and this and that and not taking in or UCI or organizers or who does what. It's just not a, there's not a good understanding of who does what for cycling.
And it's so easy to assume like a conspiracy or this desire to screw someone over. And I'm always just like, nobody has time for that.
Yeah.
Like no one's, you're giving USAC a lot of credit if you think that they, they've got time to steal your money.
Right.
You know, it's just not, no one, it's not what anyone at USAC is there for, what they're doing. So I don't know. I just, for me, USAC is Derek and Joan and previously Micah. It's Randy Schaefer. You know, it's real people who I know.
Yeah.
And because I know them, I know how hard they're working on these projects. And it, part of why I was interested in running is because I think the team that's in place right now is a really good team. And it's people that I would, if someone gave me the power to put who I wanted in place to save cycling in Colorado, these are the people that I would put in place. And so I want to get the previous administration is gone.
Right. Right. Hey, can we just like just one quick tangent since his name has come up and since he has announced that he's no longer there, can we just at least give a shout out to Micah for what he meant to that organization? I mean, here was a guy who, especially post Austin, took a lot of crap for what he was doing. And, you know, it admittedly, that was a huge screw up, you know, and they took the blame for it and try to fix it. But other than that, the work that he did and what he did for national events and just for the organization, I think he's going to be missed a lot. I mean, I miss him already being there, because I think he was somebody who was willing to listen, was willing to work hard to make changes, and also had a good sense of humor about it.
Yeah, definitely. But I think we're in good hands with Chuck Hodge and the way Micah's job has sort of maybe almost been divided a little bit between people, between Joan, who is a little more focused on membership, but Chuck as well. And I think it's amazing the amount of abuse Micah took, and it's related to that same like Facebook ranting type abuse, where Micah did sort of put his face on things and said, no, you guys, the buck will stop with me. I'll take it. He got very good at, it's not even diplomacy, because it wasn't bullshit. He wasn't bullshitting people. He gave people honest answers, and he, I think, did a good job of saying, hey, these are the challenges here. I hear what you're saying and I know what you want. But here are the challenges that we're facing trying to get that done. And I think he operated in good faith always. But I think the membership doesn't understand what the considerations are often on the other side. I don't know if their expectations are always reasonable if they understood what all the challenges to implement what it is that they actually want are. And Micah was the guy shoveling that coal always.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, let's get back to this meeting. I'll try to not go off on any other tangents.
Well, so, I mean, basically, the sport committees are not powerful. And what I mean by that is we can't make legislation. We don't have a budget to implement ideas. We are an advisory committee. And that was one of the things that I was curious about. Like, what power do we actually have? Do we get change? How do we implement change? And one of the things I was aware of and observed while I was out there is like someone like Pete Weber, who's been on the committee for a couple of years now and is very, very passionate about junior development in particular, and is out there in the field actually executing successfully junior development programs that include both recruitment of riders and development of riders who are now, many of them, performing at a high level. It's like a little micro model of what USAC should be doing for all disciplines. He's out there doing it, and he's angry. He shows up mad, and he's mad because he's been preaching and advocating and asking for things through this committee and otherwise for years and not getting any action, not seeing any of the things that he's asking for implemented. And he is feeling frustrated and powerless. And I'm as I was sort of joked about it this weekend, like I'm like the freshman senator. I'm like, yeah, we're going to save the world. We're going to make all this change. Here I am. I have all this enthusiasm. I'm not cynical quite yet, even though I've obviously been involved forever and I really do understand what, you know, what the restrictions are going to be. But so I immediately, as an example, I want to hear what Pete is angry about and figure out how I can push on his behalf. I need to take a poll for Pete right now so that he doesn't crack completely and then he doesn't walk away. And so like, how can I take the things that he's mad about and get Derek on the phone and say, hey, listen, this is what we've got to get serious about this. And, but you know, but again, the challenge is,
so what, I mean, people are going to ask, is there anything specific that you can,
well, yeah. And maybe it's good to talk about like we're free to set our own agenda. You know, like we, it's up to us to talk about what it is that we want to talk about. And the first meeting was actually a meeting to talk about what we wanted to talk about. And so the things that I think are for Cross that we talked about were definitely junior programming and support. So figuring out what is a club that's focused on juniors look like? What kind of racing structure do we need to support junior racing? How do we recruit? But then also, how does USA Cycling support that? You know, everything will come back to, are we getting staff hours from USA Cycling and are we getting money to support whatever programming we create? So staff, programming, funding, everything kept coming back to that. And ultimately that's what we were asking USA Cycling for. But we talked about NYCA a lot. Like we looked at NYCA and what a successful model that is. And everybody should be trying. If you're interested in development, if you're interested in recruitment as well as development, we've got to look at NYCA. Because that's, I'm getting ahead of myself here, but one of the big conclusions that I reached is I don't know anything about recruitment. I have never focused on recruitment. I've never thought about how to get someone who doesn't race bikes to become a bike racer. I've only ever been focused on development. Bring me the bike racer, the enthusiastic kid who's already discovered cycling, and I will help make him or her a successful person and maybe a successful bike racer.
Do you think that is a product of your environment and your community? I mean, you come from a very strong cycling area.
Yeah, definitely. I found bike racing. Bike racing was not introduced to me. I discovered it on my own. But I was lucky to come up through a club structure that developed me. And that came up a lot. Like in every sport committee, everyone my age and older lamented the wane of the club support structure. And we all talked about how do we either bring that back or how to replace the things that clubs used to provide.
Do you think bring it back? I feel like just the kind of the culture and the world has changed.
That's right. You're exactly right. And that was part of the conclusion that we reached. That culture is different. Not everybody wants to, like the rise of the 6-person rich master squad, you know, isn't a USA Cycling thing. It's a American culture thing.
Yeah.
If you're a high net worth dude who wants to race bikes with his bros and wear the same kit and have nice bikes, you maybe don't want to put a bike race on or develop junior racing unless you have kids and your kids are racing. And that is a segment to identify too. Cause I point at population curves as, the part of our problems or character of our problems that people sometimes forget about. You know, the reason I had 100 rider junior fields in the late 80s is because there were a lot of kids And the reason why you have the biggest field at Masters Nationals is 45 plus is because we are those kids.
Right.
And the reason why you're seeing growth in the teenage junior fields and in the younger juniors right now is because our kids are racing.
Yeah.
Those people that we just talked about whose kids, they're young teenagers right now. So that bump that we're seeing right now, it's pure demographic. It's population demographic. So, but we still need to get a bigger slice of that pie. You know, the people are there, we need to get them. So, yeah. So no, I think the part of the death of the club system is definitely cultural. And so, you know, professional coaches have replaced some of what you used to get from a club, which is probably for the better. You know, the quality of the advice that's out there is better. It's just, those are the themes that came up repeatedly. And so recruitment is a weakness, I think, for me personally. I don't know how to recruit. I've never thought about recruiting. But if we are going to get USA Cycling out of this decline, it's not just about signing up more fondos to buy their insurance from USA Cycling or selling more ride membership licenses to fondo riders, which are both of those things are very important. And it's where USA Cycling is focused right now in its attempt to stop the bleeding. You know, numbers are down in all disciplines.
Yeah.
And why are they down? They're down because people are doing other things, but you got to ask, why are they doing other things? Why are we losing races? Why are race promoters disappearing? And why are racers disappearing? Other ways of riding and racing bikes are part of where our customers are going. So USA Cycling as a business has to figure out how to serve those people in a way that is profitable for USA Cycling as a governing body that's essentially in the business of supporting cycling.
Well, along those lines, then, is there any talk, and this seems like an asshole question, but I'm completely serious, that you have all these athlete representatives, racing representatives, is there a ride representative, since that's what they seem to be going after?
That's a good question. No, not yet, but I could see that when that becomes a identifiable, quantifiable segment of its membership base, it would be absolutely reasonable and appropriate for someone to speak on their behalf in these meetings. But we're not there yet. That segment is being recruited currently. It doesn't exist.
When you are in these meetings, especially with the road community, is there aspersions cast upon cyclocross from road that you are somehow stealing the road racing community?
No, not at all. I mean, I know you hear people complaining about that on the internet, but that's not how road's problems are not cyclocross.
Yeah.
If anything, I think it still goes the other way because we know we're going to lose our best cyclocross athletes to the road.
Right.
And if anything, the conversation happened in terms of, think of it this way. When we talk about funding for cyclocross and how we're trying to improve cyclocross. Well, let me back up one second and say, you know, we're talking about the ride memberships and fondos, gravel races as the place that USA Cycling is going to save itself right now, which I agree with. It has to do is, I don't have a problem with that. What they're not doing is focusing at all on recruitment. There is not a person at USA Cycling whose job it is to create programming to recruit new bicycle racers. It does not exist. No one is doing that job. There is no program for it, and there is no staff person for it. In the membership department, and think in terms of there's a separation between elite athletics and membership. They have two missions, two different missions. They overlap some, but USA Cycling has this two-pronged approach to cycling, and it's good for people to get their head around that. And these things are complementary, elite athletes and membership. You can't have elite athletes without a strong membership, but there's only so much money. And elite athletics, the money for elite athletics comes primarily from US Olympic sports, USOC funding, but also the USAC Development Foundation. So people can't forget that there's a an organization comprised of high net worth men who love cycling and who decide how they want to spend their money on cycling. And they have a lot of power at USA Cycling because we are dependent on their money. Mm. And these guys like road. They like European road racing. And they want to spend their money with USA Cycling developing a program that develops riders for Olympic medals and European road racing. They do not – there is a new board member who apparently is a cyclocross fan, and we are going to try and talk to him more about diverting some of that foundation money towards cyclocross, because compared to what we need versus what the road needs, it's a drop in the bucket.
Right.
But these guys are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on the USA Cycling Elite Athletic program, road specifically, but track gets USOC funding, but they have their own challenges too. But they will always have – if they're getting medals, they're getting money.
Yeah.
No one – Jim Miller, to his credit, is occasionally able to divert some of that road money to cyclocross. And on the elite athletic side, they're really trying to help cross as much as they can. So they don't see it as something taking away. They want to support cross. And that's why our cross athletes, when they're in Europe, are able to use USAC road resources, housing, vans, staff. That USA Cycling support staff used to be done at the end of the road season. Right, Worlds was right. over.
Yeah.
They were done for the year. That support staff is now working 12 months a year because they stay and they support the cross riders on these development trips and World Cup trips. Those staff riders haven't gotten raises. I mean, staff members, support staff, they haven't gotten raises. They just have to work 12 months a year now. It's a bit of a bummer. There's no money to pay them more, but they're staying to work with the riders. So, no, it's not. They're not taken away from them. But, you know, it's really about where's the money and staff for membership development going to come from? When our membership is declining and revenue is down, where are we going to find money and staff to grow the membership? It is really a shitty spot. It's when you need to spend the money the most, you have the least amount of it.
So you talked a little bit about Nike and that does seem like it is a path to at least growing and recruiting for cyclocross. And it's something that it seems like if they can do it with mountain biking in high schools, it seems like cyclocross would be even, I don't want to say easier, but doable for the same community.
Yeah. That's right. I can go into some good detail about that because it's very interesting and there's some concrete issues there. But yeah, I asked the question rhetorically, where's the Nike for cyclocross? Where's the Nike for road racing? Well, you know, we can sort of imagine why there's no Nike for road racing to a degree, because road racing is dangerous and parents don't want to send their kids out on the road for training. You know, mountain biking is dangerous too, but it's not because of cars and open traffic. You know, it's parents are happy to let their kids ride in the woods.
Right, it's playing in the woods. I mean, parents are good with that.
As opposed to playing in the roads, right? So, but, you know, in some regions, like in New England, I'm sure they do this in other regions, but the collegiate races have started to have junior categories, high school categories. So that's a development avenue. It's not really recruitment, but it is development. So if you have a high school cycling team that is racing on the road, there are racing opportunities now in conjunction with Northeast or ECCC collegiate races, which is great. That is such a good idea because you've got to provide competitive opportunities. That's not recruitment, that's development. And that's really been on my mind a lot after this meeting, the difference between recruitment and development. But for cyclocross, if this came up a lot, one of the things you would imagine is, why can't Nike do mountain biking in the spring and cyclocross in the fall? Why don't they have a cyclocross program? Well, because in fact, Nike is hurting cyclocross in some regions because they're mountain bike racing until Thanksgiving. And so like Pete Weber has this problem where he's got 60 juniors and he loses 40 of them until Thanksgiving because they're in the racing mountain bikes for their high school program and they're not available for cyclocross and they can't do the training or do the racing until until mountain bike season is over. And in some regions, the Nika season is strongest in the fall because they are in a region where they can't race mountain bikes in the spring because of weather. Whereas in New England, I think we have a lot of spring. We still have wet weather in the spring, but we have a Nika season in the spring and one in the fall.
Yeah, and I guess the whole not going to school in the summer so throws a whole wrench in the works there.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, how do you get Nika kids to become summer mountain bike racers? Right. You know, if you're playing a school sport, a lot of kids who play school sports don't do that sport year round. They do it. They sign up for the season, and when it's over, when the programming's over, they're done. And I think that's how high school mountain bike racing goes too. It's maybe they play another sport.
Yeah.
You know, baseball season's over, and so they're playing football during football season. So they're racing mountain bikes during mountain bike season.
There is an argument for that, but I would say even within the last 20 years, that has changed. And too, I think, kids' athletics detriment, where there is a lot more pressure now to pick a sport when you're young and then do that sport. I mean, I used to coach basketball. I used to have that all the time. It'd be a kid that was great at basketball, but he was even better at baseball. And the baseball coaches were like, "You're done. You're done with basketball. Yeah. You know, yeah. You are now a baseball player. Sorry. No, I know you're 15, but that's it."
Yeah. No, NPR's really been covering this a lot lately, and they have a special coming up about it, about the specialization of high school sports and the paid camps outside of the high school leagues, and how if you want to make it in the sport, you've got to do.
Oh yeah. I mean that happened too when I was, you know, I just missed that generation, but you know, starting in the late 90s, early 2000s, especially in basketball, it was AAU. And those programs were more important than high school sports. I mean, that shift happened. It used to be the opposite.
Yeah, and here it makes me laugh sometimes because in cycling people are like, "Oh my God, junior entry fees," and I'm like, "No, that's not a limiter. I know it all feels good to give juniors like free entries, and it makes us feel like we're supporting junior racing when your entry fees for juniors are low."
You're gonna get me in trouble if we start talking about this.
Well, it's listen, like you see what these aren't. The juniors aren't working paper routes to pay their entry fees for the most part. Yeah. I was someone who did that, but generally speaking, that is not how it goes. It's youth sports are big business, and parents are spending fortunes supporting their kids in sports. So our you know, whatever $50 entry fee for a junior, which seems absolutely outrageous to me, is actually pretty affordable in comparison to what they're spending to do, you know, non-school private baseball, football, soccer, hockey leagues, in the idea that their kids are going to be professional athletes someday. Right. So we're doing pretty good with our entry fees for juniors right now.
Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. And I think that, I mean, that, you know, and I don't want to, I do want your input on this, but maybe in a different conversation. I have this whole campaign to help, you know, 20 somethings versus,
there you go. Yeah.
All of the help that we put towards juniors, because it's easy to categorize juniors. Juniors are juniors, whereas you have this whole sort of lost demographic. It's nothing new. I mean, it's just, you know, that's when you struggle in life that I'd love to see not leave cycling because they can't afford it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think we could talk a whole call about that. Yeah. It's true.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So back to this meeting. What other hot button items do you think were covered that you've been thinking about?
We talked about event support and like about the Pro CX, obviously. You know, Pro CX doesn't affect everybody. I don't think all the membership really cares exactly, but as fans, we care about the Pro CX. And, you know, the conclusion that we kind of reached or the thing that we talked about is along the lines of what I've been preaching all along, which is the Pro CX is a calendar. It's not a series. Calendars and series do different things. USA Cycling is responsible for the calendar, not for a series. It can't and shouldn't run a national series. A national series is something that a private third-party business venture should run. The consensus and from USA Cycling is that is not what the US Cup is. It's an attempt in that direction. But USA Cycling doesn't own or operate the US Cup. The U.S. Cup isn't even a UCI series, even though it's a collection of UCI races. It's not a formal UCI series like the Vittoria series is. But it is a thing that we all want. We all want it to be successful. We want good storytelling through big races where we know the best riders in the country will come to each round. And that's what the U.S. Cup is attempting to do. That's a series. That is not what the Pro CX is or what the Pro CX is designed to do. The Pro CX is a collection of races around the country that have met a minimum standard. And right now that minimum standard is UCI status plus some additional administrative and promotional things that you are aware that we need to do. And so in that sense, it serves the purpose it's designed to do. If people understand what it is, like if you expect the Pro CX to be a national series, you're not listening. You're missing the point about what it actually does and what it's for and why we have it. And when a calendar doesn't meet the expectations of a series, it doesn't mean that the calendar is broken or that it has to go away or that we shouldn't have it. It means you just have to actually understand what it is and what it does and why it's there. We need both. We need a calendar, and within that calendar, we need a collection of some big races, a series that people can follow. That's somebody else's job, not USA Cycling's job.
Yep.
Pro CX could use better storytelling and support from USA Cycling, though, and that is something that we talked about. There should be a press release every Monday that says, here are the races this weekend, here's who did well, here are the stories from those races, and here are the current standings based on that, and here's what's coming up next week.
We do get those press releases. I just think that I agree with you, but maybe the scope and direction of those releases needs to be changed so it's more globally. Right now, it's just really almost race support. I mean, stuff that the organizer should be doing that Pro CX is kind of complementing or even doing for them.
Well, right. And again, there's no staff person at USA Cycling responsible for that. There has been in the past, but right now, you know, as you know,
but there's still a contract out there.
That's what I was going to say. It's being subcontracted. Yeah. But I'm not, was there a press release on Monday about what happened in the Pro CX last weekend? I didn't see it. If there was, you know,
well, I mean, but the other problem in that is, and I'm looking now in my mail because I believe there was. But here's the thing. It's in my inbox. Yeah, Pro Cyclocross results, KMC Cross Fest Friday, C1 events, and show our U.S. Cup leaders, September 29th. Yeah, I get these press releases. And I know that other people on the media list get these press releases as well. And it goes back to what you were saying about there needs to be better storytelling, or that it's so big that somebody needs to care. I don't really care.
Yeah.
That's the thing is, like, I am going to cover, you know, if we talk about me and what I do, I am going to cover these races. I have people at these races. I pay for people to be at these races. And I supply that coverage. But it's still on a race-to-race basis. There are stories to be told, but it's not like I'm... Here is in the Crosshairs coverage of the Pro CX. Mm-hmm. And this is not it goes to what we're talking about. This is not a knock on USA Cycling. It's not a knock on the Pro CX on that calendar, but it is that. It's 30 some races. It doesn't mean anything to me. You know, the US Cup, and I agree with you. We still need to see what happens with this, if it becomes the series that we wanted to, but you got to admit, week one worked out about perfect for them. You couldn't have asked for better results.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I mean, you have three women tied at the top. You have Tobin winning the men's, which, I mean, we all know he's a strong rider and can beat the other guys at the top, and nobody was going to say that he was going to be the guy going into week two with this big lead and having the, quote, favorites chasing him.
Mm-hmm.
So, so there are those stories. I know it's, you know, I know your series is on that level too. I'm not knocking it, but I'm saying this is what this was set out to do. it could have gone another way. But right now, story-wise, they're set up in a really nice place.
Absolutely. So these things aren't contradictory. Both things need to exist. Maybe one of the comparison I'd make is you followed – no one is following the UCI points standings the same way they're necessarily focusing or following the Super Prestige, right? So let's compare those two things. You're going to follow the 8 races in the Super Prestige, and you're going to follow each race, and you're going to pay a little bit of attention to the standings, but you're interested in the race itself. But there are also UCI points and point standings that get updated.
I don't know if I agree with that.
You check those points, right? You care who's on top of the UCI points,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. I mean,
So that's what the calendar is. Right. That's what the Pro CX is. The Pro CX is the American distillation.
Yes, I agree with that.
Of the UCI calendar. Well, and so if you if one understands that, then one's expectations get set accordingly. And
I mean, it's a gauge to see where people are and where they are going to, you know, where they stand. It's like it's an overall stand. Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, we are always going to check the UCI one. It's important for World Cups. It's this barometer overall. It's taking in all these series. It's taking in the DVVA,
right,
the Super Prestige and Vittoria and the US Cup. And it's saying, okay, they're not all racing together. Let's look at the UCI and see where they are. And then we'll have the World Cups when these guys get to bash heads against each other. And then that's even more points. So yeah.
How many baseball games happened last weekend?
Right.
You didn't watch them all. You can't watch them all. And it wasn't just the best players in America or in the world in only one game. There were games everywhere, in every region, for lots of regional fans to spectate and athletes to compete.
But that's also – that's apples to oranges. Because sports, team sports are set up differently. Team sports are set up as standings. If you want to say, okay, this week we're going to have Wout Van Aert versus Matthew Vanderpool. We're going to have Kevin Powles versus, you know, Lars Vanderhaar head to head. I mean, they're different. People follow them differently. People follow sports differently.
Right. But I think we agree. And this is what I'm saying. I don't think we disagree. I think we actually agree. This is the difference between a calendar and a series.
Yeah.
And that's the only point I'm making, and I think you agree with me on that.
Yeah.
And
so 100%.
We can go down the rabbit hole about how each one of those things are working and how they do what they do. And really, to bring it back around, all I'm saying is the calendar does what it's designed to do, but it could get supported a little bit better so that there was just a little more awareness about what it is, what it does, what it tracks. Mm-hmm. And I think as the calendar owner, USA Cycling could give that a little bit more support. People don't even understand what the calendar is and how it does and what it does. And so that's part of, there could be better messaging from USA Cycling about the calendar so that expectations were set and people realized what information they should be pulling from the fact that the calendar exists. And it's different than what a series provides.
I guess my question then is, where does that messaging go? And the criticism I hear from sort of my side of things is, well, why doesn't the, finger quote, media cover cyclocross anymore? Why isn't Velo News there? Why isn't, you know, whomever? And my answer to that always is, why should they be? You know, what is the incentive to be there? It doesn't seem like the support for it necessarily is there to cover the cost. I mean, it all comes down, everything is money, right? So yeah. if there's going to be no return at a certain level, these are business decisions, and why are you going to send somebody there?
Well, yeah, sure.
Talk about messaging, but there has to be, it's still, you know, it's more than that. More is broken than just that.
And what you're talking about is reporters on the ground at events, and that's a separate conversation. So I agree with you on that one. You've got that model's gone, right? They haven't been sending reporters to events
for a decade.
For years. Yeah. And I think one of the things that a quote unquote national series is supposed to provide is a thing where the media can say, okay, these are the four weekends or eight races we're going to cover because we know the best riders are going to be there, and it allows everybody to narrow their focus. And so we can commit to covering this rather than the 40 races on the calendar. That's fine. That's the point. That's what a series is supposed to do. So how does that happen with a calendar? Well, I think the way it happens with a calendar is if you're media, if you're Cycling News, Velo News, whatever, if you're everything other than Cyclocross Magazine, what are you looking for? How much bandwidth do you have to cover things?
And I can tell you, even Cyclocross Magazine, because I know, because they used our stuff, wasn't at Rochester. So, I mean, even your dedicated news outlets, I mean, they covered it, right.
They're going to rely on someone locally maybe to cover it. But what I think is possible, if they thought it was something, if they thought that this is an article people would read, I would suggest that every Monday the media can say what happened on the Pro CX this weekend. So here's our
But I think we're doing that. We're just not calling it Pro. What happened? That's the thing. It's like that
Cyclocross Roundup. There can be a U.S. Cyclocross.
Yeah, I mean that happens. That happens. But to say that, you know, people need to know what that is going to happen, and it's going to be, I guess it's words. I mean, we're covering the UCI races, which are the Pro CX, but it doesn't have that whole Pro CX thing hasn't caught on. That's the part of it.
Well, and so I think if USA Cycling was doing different messaging, if USA Cycling was drawing a circle around it and saying these are our premier events, and just making sure that they were, I don't think people always know. I think people forgot that there was a race in Sacramento last weekend because they were all focused on KMC. People forgot that there was a conflicting race.
Yeah.
But USA Cycling's Pro CX Twitter did a good job of covering Sacramento and bumping what was happening in Sacramento. So I don't know if it's I'm blanking on the woman's name who was the contractor for the Pro CX media, but I assume she's responsible. Yeah, I assume it was Jackie responsible for sending those tweets out, but I paid attention to that. I was like, oh, right.
Well, no, they do. I mean, they are the one organization that does have somebody at each event. I mean, and they are contracting out to other people to make sure. I mean, I know I have people who are helping out in that cause. So this is happening, you know, is on the Instagram and on the Twitter.
Yeah.
The one thing, though, is that there's still, I mean, where I think where it falls down a little bit is, you know, just kind of the social media tsunami we live in, is that finding that in there is tough. And if you look at the Pro CX account, I don't think it's 2,000, you know, followers. So
this is where I think the messaging has to be better and stronger.
That
and,
I agree
and
with.
Again, differentiated between from a series. And so without the Pro CX, maybe Sacramento doesn't get that bump. Maybe people don't even realize there's a UCI race in Sacramento last weekend. So that's the value of a calendar. Well, let me quickly run through the other topics that we covered, and we'll see what we want to pick out of that. So like we already talked about junior programming, and we just talked about Pro CX and kind of event support, you know, how USA Cycling can support the events. We talked about elite athlete support, and I already filled you in a little bit about that when we skipped around. And one part of that was really great is Jim Miller came in and talked to us. And obviously I've known of Jim Miller for a very long time, but he and I, for whatever reason, have never communicated. I've never really had any overlap. Hadn't been in the same room at the same time before.
That's interesting.
It's just weird that it's gone that way. It was almost like we're old friends who hadn't met, and that's how we treated each other. It was really great. I learned probably the most from him all weekend in all the conversations I had, and in understanding how elite athletics works and how it's funded. And I would have assumed that he didn't care about cross if I was on the outside looking in and didn't know. I would have been insecure about our position and defensive. And it turns out that if Jim Miller had money to give us, he'd give it to us. He likes cross. He likes bike racers. He likes bike racing. He's one of those guys that he's still there at USA Cycling, still involved in the sport because he loves it first and foremost. And I felt a real kinship with him. And he's a real straight shooter. And people can have problems with his decisions or, you know, criticize the conclusions that he reaches or whatever, but man, I like that guy. And I'm impressed at his grasp of he's got a big and hard job and he's good at it. And his ability to see the vision and all the moving parts, have a big vision and all the moving parts was impressive. So that was great. We talked about national championships. We talked about club system and support of the club system, which I already hit on a little bit. And we talked about some of the new rules that are coming up and some rule changes. So let's talk briefly about national championships, because I think that's something that everybody's interested
in. Yeah, that was going to be the one that I was going to ask about. I'll let you go. I was just going to say, is there a recognition from the other disciplines that this is somewhere that cyclocross excels?
Yeah, definitely. And that point was even made to them. Like, we had to do summary presentations to all the other committees at the end of the meetings. The last meeting we had is all the committees in a room together and one person speaking on behalf of each committee to all of the committees. And I got tasked with that job. And that was one of the points that I made, that we have a very unique national championships model, and it is clearly the most successful one. Nationals still lost money, apparently, in Hartford, which I was surprised to learn, because I think
people want that production, and that costs a lot of money.
Yeah, but we throw the best party, and I think part of that is because we have every age group and all together.
And abilities, age groups and abilities from people who, you know, just started racing and are going to nationals. I mean, it's kind of crazy. Yeah. It's amazing.
And then, of course, our participants turn into spectators, which is basically our model for cross in general right now at a UCI race as well. But so people do stick around, you know, you race on Friday and you stick around and watch the elite race and you go home Sunday night, maybe, you know, not everybody does that, but it is a big part.
To the point that is the biggest, you know, I think, hurdle that USA Cycling has in trying to organize it and where to put people in their races, especially when you're starting on a Wednesday. And it's kind of interesting. I mean, that is what upsets people is not necessarily a bad thing, that they don't want to go home. They want to be able to see the elites race, but if they're racing on Wednesday, it's sometimes tough.
Yeah. Yeah. And it turns into a cyclocross vacation for people, and that will be easier to do in December. You know, we can have a phone call just about January versus December nationals. We don't need to get into all those details now, but certainly that will be, nationals is only going to be bigger when it happens in December. We know this. We know that there are many, many people who can't extend their seasons to January, for better or for worse, that will be at a December nationals. And so, I think that a December nationals is going to lower the rider quality, perhaps. But it's certainly going to increase the rider quantity. And I think we're going to have a problem, in fact, because we already have a few fields that are more or less full, and we have lapped rider problems in some of those categories. My category is the biggest problem with that. And single speed is the biggest field. Overall, they had 160 riders. I don't think anyone's too stressed about lapped traffic in a single speed race, but lapped traffic in a 45-plus race is – In a way that maybe it potentially affects the winner, you know, the important, you know, it's at national championships. I think the front of the race should be the priority. It's a national championships. It's not a participation oriented event. Same thing with the UCI race, but like, you know, leaving lapped riders in the masters fields at a UCI race makes perfect sense. It's participant oriented, development oriented even. I'm not sure if that should be the case at nationals, but that is the conclusion that has been reached, that they want every customer to get to the end of their race.
Well, that's the problem is, or the, that's the reason is that word, it's customer and it customer, customer experience. So I think that it's maybe part of the work that has to be done is changing the expectation of the customer.
Well, but unfortunately, as it turns out, that largest field based on population curve, the 45 plus field, they're also the biggest jerks on social media and complaining via email. So it's they're able to exert a lot of pressure and create a lot of negative publicity for USA Cycling.
Yeah.
So some 45 plus guy gets gets pulled in his master's race at nationals and doesn't understand or thinks that somehow they deserve to race the full distance, even though they're getting lapped at a national championship. Those people are able to create enough noise to overshadow what might have been a successful event and have the perception
crazy.
Of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so they made a lot of noise, and USA Cycling, unfortunately, has recognized that it causes more harm than good to pull those riders, even though it's nationals.
Well, maybe it's time. I mean, I wonder if we can argue again for some tough love. And it, as you say, there's going to be a bigger pool to choose from. So if people are unsatisfied with only getting a 25-minute race because they're getting lapped, and you know, I mean, that's a cultural change I'd like to see.
Yeah, well, and here's how we talked about addressing that, is how to restrict fields in those amateur classes. We have already done a good job of restricting the elite races through qualification procedures that involve points and also having to choose between masters and elites. Those things have made the elite field an appropriate size and ability level, quality. The range of quality is narrower, and that's a better race now because of it. USA Cycling needs entry fees, right? Like, they're trying to turn a profit or at least not lose money on this event. So they have a weird conflict here where they want manageable field sizes of good quality, but they also need to take every dollar they can get in terms of entry fees. So you can't, even though it's people responsible for their own fate, do you just keep taking people's entry fee money even though you know that they're Cat 3s who are going to be lining up in 150th position and are going to be lapped in two laps? Like, do you protect people from themselves by saying no?
Yeah.
No, we're not going to let you register because we know you're going to have a bad experience. Even though you want to register and sign up for this bad experience that we know you're going to complain about later. It's like, do you save them? You know, what do you do there? Well, the answer is right now you take their money and try to provide them with an experience they're not going to complain about. So one way we talked about doing that is even restricting some of the masters fields by category further. And this wouldn't be for Reno, this would be for Louisville. But we know that Louisville, or we believe that Louisville, is going to be the biggest nationals ever because it's going to draw from all of the regions. We think Reno might be down because we think a lot of the East Coasters aren't going to go to Reno. And Reno doesn't have the same local population of cyclocrossers to draw from that some other regions might. But we're hoping that the Northwest cross scene gives it a bump as more of those riders are participating in USAC events. You know, we get more of the Seattle and Portland cross scenes to actually come to nationals. Maybe they'll make up for the lost East Coast ridership with more support from those non-USAC, traditionally non-USAC areas. But, restricting them by category. So right now it's restricted to Cat 1 through 3 for, I can't remember where that cutoff happens, at maybe below 60 plus. I think it's 60 plus, it's probably open, maybe 50 plus, I can't remember. But if you want to use 45 plus as an example, right now it's restricted to 1 through 3s, but what if it was 1s and 2s only?
Yeah.
And so one of the things we're talking about is making it open initially to only Cat 2s and above up until a certain date. And then if there are spots remaining, opening it up to Cat 3s, you know, in the last 2 weeks before the event or something like that, or in the last month before the event, as a way to make sure that all the high-level riders have a chance to register and commit. And then we see what the field size is. And then if the field size is small or the field can handle more capacity, at that point, you let Cat 3s register as well.
Yeah, I think that's smart. And I think that it's... that's.
I don't like the way that feels, but I think it's logical.
I don't know. I understand the need for having people there. At the same time, a national championship should be just that. It should be special. It should be the best riders who compete. I want to... You know, there are non-championship races, so if everybody wants to race on the course, they can. But it seems like, to a certain extent, you should have to at least earn it by, yeah, being a Cat 2. And maybe that'll, you know, light a fire under some folks who are been Cat 3s for a while who want to race nationals to get that upgrade or at least apply for it.
Yeah, I like restriction by category as well, because I think that happens then over the course of a season at your local races. It's a season-long goal. You know what your level is. Absolutely, I think it's a great thing. And then, but I understand why they're not pulling lapped riders at nationals in those categories. I still think I don't agree with it, but I hear the marketing reasons for doing so and how powerful those voices are in terms of engendering ill will towards USA Cycling.
Yeah. I wonder how powerful they would be after not having their way for a year. Look, both of us have done this with our series. We've had to piss off groups of people who over time have adjusted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the problem is expectations are different regionally. So I don't think those complainers were New Englanders, right?
Right.
Because the New Englanders are used to a system. Maybe they weren't Mid-Atlantic riders because the Mid-Atlantic riders are used to a system. I don't know where those complaints come. And I don't want to like single Colorado out or blame Colorado. But when I look at the category structure, for instance, that Without Limits is running in their races in Colorado right now, it looks like an amateur mountain bike race. They are dividing infinitely by age and ability.
Yeah.
Down to categories so small that literally, well, figuratively anyway, everyone's a winner.
Right.
There's just, and all these people come and they get their sub categories and they can feel good about their result, but the quality of the racing is maybe not good because of it, because they're so subdivided. They don't consider peers based just on ability. They consider peers based on age as well. And I think it's, catering too much to the entitled bike racer mentality.
Yeah.
Insert your Boulder jokes here, I guess. But I don't know. Maybe it's working for them. Maybe their numbers are good. I hear a lot of complaints about it. I'm not there racing the races or observing it, but I am hearing a lot. People are complaining directly to me about it. And I asked Pete for some more background on it so I could just have a better sense of it. And I'm being a little bit funny here, and I don't want anyone from Boulder to get mad at me. I'm definitely making some jokes here, but I do think that kind of infinite subdivision of categories perpetuates that. Even though this is nationals, I paid my entry fee and I want to do the full race distance.
Yeah.
You know, I just think, well, yeah, no, not at nationals. Sorry, this is a championship race, right? And you are deprioritized. The priority here is the front of the race, and the front of the race should get protected. That's not really good for business, unfortunately.
Yep. Well, speaking of that, we're going to get in trouble if we go too long, because people who want to race for a long time want their podcast to be only a certain time, and we're at an hour 20. So what other items do you think, what is a final item that we can stick our landing on?
What I would say is, being in Colorado, being at USAC headquarters, seeing the offices, I mean, I've been there before, as you have as well, but I think when you're in the office and you're really rolling up your sleeves and getting to work on these things and talking to people who work on it every day, you realize the enormity of the task and the countless and infinite challenges that go into solving to what people at home on Facebook in front of their computers think are simple problems with simple solutions. Those people can't even begin to comprehend the barriers in the way of solving some of those problems. And it's not until you roll up your sleeves and start working on them that you uncover all of these barriers. And I don't think things are going to get fixed quickly. I think right now, Derek and USA Cycling is, to a certain degree, they have to be focused both on membership and elite athletics. And so Derek talks about Tokyo a lot right now. I don't think the membership gives a shit about Tokyo. I don't think that's necessarily what they want to hear. But if you're trying to run USA Cycling and you're trying to generate revenue for USA Cycling and you have this dual-pronged goal of elite and Olympic athletics as well as membership, right now, the focus has to be on Tokyo. It's got to be on medals. It's got to be on finding money for Tokyo, and so that it generates more money for USA Cycling in the future, and also continues to support our international level stage races, Colorado, Utah, California, and that that calendar of racing. Separately and sometimes contradictory is this membership aspect that I've been talking about. And like I said, right now that membership growth is focused on plugging the holes, stopping the bleeding through Fondo and gravel ride recruitment and ride membership sales. I find that incomplete. I think USA Cycling's hole for membership is new rider recruitment. And that is not on the agenda. There is not a staff person dedicated to that. I do not hear a plan in place for that. And that is a discovery for me. That is a thing that I learned from being out there. That is a conclusion that I've just reached. And I don't have a solution for it either. I have some ideas. I have some brainstorming. I'm going to think more about it. But I've never tackled that goal, that problem either. And it's not my biggest area of interest. It's not going to be that fun. I like working with athletes. I don't necessarily want to have to talk someone into being a bike racer, but someone does need to. And I will say that the thing that I pushed probably the most and talked about the most is this Cycling Made Real program, that I'm going to talk about on my podcast shortly, but as a model already in place, now defunct, but still documented on the internet. Focused around women, Cat 4 first, and then Cat 3 women. Women's recruitment and development. That's the key.
Yeah.
Recruitment and development. Not just development, not just racing opportunity, but recruitment. Not just lowering barriers of entry, but even reaching across those barriers to those non-racers and introducing them to racing. That's what's going to sell licenses.
Yep.
And a bigger membership pool means better elite athletics.
Yeah.
It's a bigger pool to draw from.
That's great. So, yeah. I look forward to listening to that. So the Meyerson line, we can look forward to it on there.
Yeah. Sorry. It's been almost a year since we podcasted, but I finally have something scheduled and we'll get that up. Recording that tomorrow. Well, who knows when people listen to this, but recording that, be recording it on Friday, October 6th.
Great.
So you'll see it shortly after that.
So people can go to wideanglepodium.com after that time, and it will be posted up there for you to listen to. That's outstanding. Adam, thanks so much for chatting this. I always enjoy our conversations, and I think we did a pretty good job keeping on task here.
Absolutely. I think what we should probably do, much like you did with Dan last week, is we should have a periodic check-in where we can just unpack what we're looking at and just let the conversation go where it wants. But I'm glad that we had an opportunity to talk about this specific stuff, because I did want to give people a bit of a summary and let them know, like, here's what I'm trying to do on your behalf.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I agree also. We should definitely do at least every 3 weeks to a month. I'd love to get you on the phone and do that. So we should plan on it. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
All right, there you have it. Always great to hear from Adam. Hey, remember, healthiq.com/cxhairs. Go get a lower quote on life insurance after taking their quiz and qualifying. Healthiq.com/cxhairs. Go do it. You've been putting it off. Go do it now. Also, wideanglepodium.com. One of the shows I didn't mention is the Meyerson line that's coming back. Adam's got one show already recorded, working on some others, so that's pretty awesome to have him back in the fold. So go check out Adam's show as well, and then you could become a member and support the Meyerson line along with whatever other shows you want to support. That's kind of the cool thing, you get to go in there, and when you become a member and support the podcast network for every month, is that you get to pick the shows that you want to support. You can support all of them. You can just support Crosshairs Radio if you want. Maybe you want to support the Bike Shop CX show. Didn't mention them in the beginning either. They're killing it. Those guys are great. So wideanglepodium.com. See you at Charm City this weekend if you're listening to this before that happens. And yeah, have a good one. Go race your bike.